All right, so don't forget your manual week to week, because you'll need it every day, every time we're in here. The activity we're doing today, since I switched the order, as I already announced, is the saltwater boiling one. And so even though I had given you a packet already in PDF form online, this one is the newer packet, so obey the stuff that's in the manual. And also, even though that whole chapter is important, so I want you to look at that eventually, you can skip right to the procedure part once I shut up, which is page 39. That's where you'll start the actual activity. And also, you should work in at least pairs, two or three, depending on who's at your table. Don't do it alone, in other words, even though this week it would be possible to do it alone, but it's better to work together. Before I let you loose on the actual experiment today, well, first of all, let me say that this is the first of those three meetings that you have to do a laboratory report for. Remember, on the first day I said that three of the weeks involve a report. This is the first of those. And remember, these are not formal reports. Each report is simply a matter of answering the questions in the instructions for the report, which is in this chapter as well, on page 41. So keep in mind, that has to be a Word document electronically submitted through Canvas, and there's only one thing that you submit. So if you do a hand-drawn graph, which it tells you to do, you're going to need to take a snapshot of that and insert it into the doc before you upload it. Don't do separate uploads. Don't hand it to me hard copy. Don't try to email it to me. Okay? And I have long forgotten when the due date for that is, but it's on Canvas, so don't forget it. Use the assignment schedule page throughout the course, because that's all in the order in which you have to hand things in. Also, before I let you loose on it, I need to give you a little bit of important preliminary information, which is what this slide is all about, today's important concepts. The first of which is careful liquid measurement. We have to measure liquids all the time for various reasons, and you have a bunch of glassware and plasticware on your trays, which are some of the ways that you can measure liquids or at least contain them. By the way, what we better officially say what these things are called. What is this cylindrical one called? That is a beaker. What about the conical ones? It's an Erlenmeyer flask, or just a flask. And then you have various sizes of what? What are these? Graduated cylinders. They're also cylinders, of course, but they have graduations on them, little tick marks. Actually, so does the beaker, and so do the Erlenmeyer flasks. They have volume markings. But a beaker or a flask is never a good thing to use for careful liquid measurement. It just gives you a rough idea. You wouldn't use it for the measurement itself. Instead, you want to use a graduated cylinder or even smaller cylinders called pipettes that we'll deal with later, but there are various size glass pipettes for measuring even smaller volumes of liquid. And for tiny volumes of liquid, like microliters, there are micropipettes that we'll also deal with later. We'll use those in a future meeting. But why? What is the big deal about a graduated cylinder compared to a beaker, which is also really a cylinder? Why would you use a graduated cylinder instead of a beaker for careful measurement? But why? I mean, what is it about a graduated cylinder that gives it? No? Well, what is it? And don't overthink this. What if I were to ask a kid, what is the difference between this graduated cylinder and this beaker, other than the material they're made out of, which is what a kid would say probably. What? That's not what a kindergartner would say.
One's tall, one's fat.
Yes, one of them is fat and one of them is thin. That's the big deal. Right? If you're pouring liquid into something, the narrower it is, the greater that level is going to change with that given volume that you're delivering, right? You wouldn't want to accurately measure a cup of water by putting it into a sheet pan, right? It's going to be a sheet of water. You can't tell how tall it is. But for the same volume, if you put that into a narrow cylinder, that's going to change the level of the liquid greatly, and therefore there's a lot of room to space out your markings so that you can get accurately on one graduation or one marking. Does that make sense? In other words, the smaller the diameter of a cylinder, the greater resolution you have in your measurement. So that's why you use a graduated cylinder instead of these others to measure it to begin with. And then you could pour it into one of these others, and it should roughly match up to that volume marking on the big one, but you don't use the beaker or the flask to measure it to begin with. Also, you don't use just any graduated cylinder. You should always use the graduated cylinder that is the smallest one that is big enough to do the job. If you wanted to measure a liter of water, it wouldn't be appropriate to choose this smallest one that you have sitting out. Why is that? It won't hold a liter, and therefore what? Well, yes, if you try to pour the liter, it will overflow, but assuming you don't do that, what is the other problem? You could use this to measure a liter, but what? How would you have to do it?
Tediously.
Meaning what? Multiple times, right. You'd have to use it multiple times, making multiple measurements, each of which has a little bit of error associated with it. And therefore, if you have to make a lot of measurements, those errors can add up to a bigger error. So it's more appropriate to use one that can hold a liter, designed for a liter. But in any case, you use the smallest one that is big enough to do it in just one measurement for maximum accuracy. All right, now, you mentioned a meniscus. That's next on this list. What is a meniscus? This was covered in the pre-lab. Well, the meniscus itself is a curvature on the surface of a liquid. And it can be either a negative meniscus, which is concave, or it can be a positive meniscus, depending on the liquid. In here, you'll only encounter negative menisci because although the liquids we deal with in this lab involve water, water forms a negative meniscus, a downward curvature. But they're getting hard to find because buildings don't want to have the mercury in the building anymore for safety reasons. But if you look at a mercury barometer, for instance, which is mercury in a tube, it will have a positive meniscus. Either way, that's a problem. A meniscus is a problem. If you think about wanting to measure accurately the level of liquid, it would be nice if it were perfectly level, because then you could match it up to the graduations, right? But it never is. It's a meniscus, either positively or negatively. And the reason that's a problem is because you don't really know where the level is. It's somewhere between these two extents, but if you mentally push down on the top to level it all out, it's somewhere in between that you really can't tell by looking at it. That would be the truth, of course, right? That would be the real measurement, but it's impossible. And therefore, in science we have conventions, which simply means scientists get together and decide what to do universally, so everyone does it the same way. And the convention for reading a meniscus is that we don't read the edge where it hits the glass, we use the curved part in both cases. That would be the bottom for a negative meniscus or the top for a positive meniscus. Even though that is slightly wrong, we always do it that way for consistency. And by the way, that requires you getting your eye down to the level of the graduated cylinder. You're going to get the wrong, maybe drastically wrong measurement if you have your graduated cylinder down on the desk and say, oh, that looks like 32 milliliters. You're going to run into what's called parallax error. For instance, if I put my hand in front of this, or just a mark, if I just make a little mark on the wall, I put my hand here, and I say, is that mark to the right or to the left of my arm? It depends on where you're viewing it from. Right? It would only be, you could only really get the real answer if you are directly perpendicular to the board. And there aren't all that many needle meters anymore. They're usually digital. But on old electronic equipment, there would be a needle meter, but the needle is in front of the surface of the scale. So if you looked at it from one angle or another, you would be reading different numbers. And the good ones had a little mirror right behind the needle, so that if you were at the wrong angle, you would see the needle itself and a reflection of the needle. But it forced you to get right in front of it where the image disappeared, the mirror image disappeared. You're looking only at the needle. That shows you that you're right in front of that scale. Similarly, you need to be right down at the level of the meniscus to actually get a good measurement, a good reading of it. All right. Next are four definitions, but these three with S's in them are, we'll deal with as it, kind of all at once, solution, solvent, and solute. These are applicable to today's exercise because we're dealing with solutions. A solution, though, is a particular kind of mixture. There are different mixtures. A solution is one type of mixture. But in any given mixture, it's more than one thing, right? That's what makes it a mixture. For a solution, it's specifically a mixture in which one thing is dissolved in another thing. And so solutions can be either liquids or gases. In other words, they're fluids. Fluid means either a liquid or a gas. But we're dealing with liquid solutions today. So the solution is the overall mixture. Its two components are solvent and solute, though. The solvent is the thing that is doing the dissolving. And it's usually the thing that there's a lot more of. And the solute, which there can be one or more types, the solute is the thing being dissolved by the solvent. So the overall mixture is the solution. In today's example, what is the solution? It's not salt. Salt water is the solution. What's the solvent? Water. And salt is the solute. Actually, when you get down to it, the specific salt we're using is sodium chloride. And when it dissolves, it is no longer sodium chloride. It breaks into sodium ions and chloride ions, so really you have two solutes, but they're solutes, not solvents. Water is the solvent. All right, that's those three. Molarity is just one measure of what we call concentration. There's multiple ways of measuring concentration, but concentration in general, concentration of a solution, refers to relatively how much solute is there compared to the other components in the solution. And so you can think of it as the strength. For salt water, how salty it is an indication of its concentration. And so there are different choices of units we can use for that. But the one we're going to use here is molar. Molar is the unit. And its symbol is just capital M. Now, why does that not mean mega, which is also capital M? Exactly right. You would never use mega by itself. But M by itself, therefore, means molar. And the definition of molar as a unit is, well, first of all, do you think it's derived or fundamental? It is derived. It is defined as the moles, the number of moles of solute per liter of solution. And remember what a mole is, Avogadro's number, right? 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd power is one mole. Well, how many of those you have in 1 liter of the overall solution is the molarity in units of molar. You're using four so-called solutions today. I say so-called because one of them is zero molar. So there really isn't any solute in this, right? This is just pure water. We call it a solution anyway. The others, though, are definitely proper solutions because it's water and salt. 1 molar, 3 molar, and 5 molar are what you're using. These are just demo beakers. You're not opening these up, but it just shows you how much salt is 1 mole, 3 moles, and 5 moles. So in that liter bottle of the one labeled 1 molar, there's this much salt, there's this much in the 3 molar, and there's this much in the 5 molar. And concentration is per liter, so if you have 5 liters, it would be 5 times this much salt, and so on. That's concentration. That's molar concentration. Does that all make sense? Physical and chemical changes, obviously different from each other. A chemical change is one that changes the substance. So you have something before the reaction, you have something else after the reaction, which we'll talk much more about in lecture. But you no longer have the same stuff if a chemical reaction occurs. Not true for a physical reaction. Now, you're boiling today. If you boil the pure water, which is one of your substances, or if you just, I'm sure you have boiled water in your existence so far, what happens there? Is that a chemical or a physical change? It is physical because you don't change any molecules. You start with a huge population of water molecules that we call liquid water. And when you boil it, you force some of those water molecules to go off on their own in the gas phase. It's still a water molecule, though. It doesn't make sense, by the way, for a single when you're talking about a single water molecule, it doesn't make sense to use the words liquid, solid, or gas, the states of matter. Those refer to populations of particles, not a single particle. What is the difference, by the way, between a liquid and a gas? What really defines it? Gas is what? Well, yeah, air is gas.
How closely they are interacting with each
other? Yes, how closely spaced or far spaced they are. That's really the difference. So it's water molecules in both cases. The individual molecules are totally the same in both situations. But in a liquid, they're very close together. In a gas, it's mostly spaced, distance between them. All right. So boiling just allows some of those water molecules to leave that closely congregated population and go off space apart with fellow gas molecules. Okay, that's a chemical change. I mean, a physical change. Independent, well, variables in general we need to get to next, because you're doing an experiment here today, unlike last time when you just listened to me. And scientific experiments involve variables. Of course, variables are things that can vary. Their values can change. There's all kinds of variables in the universe. The vast majority of those variables in the universe have nothing to do with the experiment you're trying to conduct. And they have the it's possible for those variables that are unrelated to the experiment to actually affect the experiment when you don't want them to affect it. And therefore, we call those variables controlled variables. They're called that because if you set things up well, what you're trying to do is keep those variables from varying. That way, they won't affect what you're trying to do in your experiment. Okay, now, it's better to just think of an example here. If I have an experiment on plants that I want to conduct, I want to see whether there is an effect of the concentration of a nutrient solution on the growth rate of a plant. Well, there's all kinds of variables that could affect growth rate, right? Like the amount of sunlight or the amount of water that you give them or the kind of pot they're in, the kind of plant it is. Those are all controlled variables because I don't want those things to have any effect on the experiment. So for each of my replicates, I would make sure it's the same species of plant. I would make sure that they start out the same size. They have the same soil, the same pot, same amount of sunlight, and all the other kinds of variables that are not related to the experiment. Those are collectively called controlled variables. That leaves two other categories, though, which do have something to do with the experiment, and those are the independent variable and the dependent variable, which are two variables that a lot of people confuse early on. Now, usually, I suggest that you think about things linguistically, if you haven't already noticed that in lecture. But at least at first, I want you to think about these two in terms of practical definitions, in other words, how they're used. In any given experiment, the dependent variable is the thing that you, as the scientist, measure. And the independent variable is the thing that you as a scientist adjust for your various replicates, however many replicates you're doing. Like today you're doing 4 replicates. All right, so in the plant example, go ahead.
So the dependent variable would be the time or distance?
No, because there is no aspect of time that you're dealing with today. A lot of people make that mistake, by the way. So don't tell me in your report that you measured time. You didn't, or you won't today. You're not measuring how long it takes for anything to boil. You're measuring the temperature at which boiling occurs, however long it takes to get there. Right? But don't think about today's what you're doing. Think about my example, the plant one. What is the dependent variable?
Growth.
Growth rate. Yes, rate of growth. So how many millimeters per week or whatever is how I could measure it in, whatever units I want to use. Yes, that's what I measure. So that's the dependent variable. And the independent variable? Well, I said that it was nutrients, though, in my example. Sunlight would be a controlled variable, then. I wanted to test the effect of the concentration of a nutrient solution on growth rate. So the independent variable is concentration of solution. That's what I'm adjusting in the experiment if I were to conduct that. All right? Now, linguistically, these names make sense as well. The dependent variable gets its name from the fact that it's possible for that variable to depend on the value of the thing that you manipulate, which is the independent variable. Right? That's why it's called the dependent variable. In fact, it might not actually depend, and even if it doesn't, we still call it the dependent variable. But that's how it got its name. And that's made more clear when we talk about graphing. Nearly every scientific experiment, once it's published, involves using graphs to display results, because they're really efficient ways to visually get an idea of what went on in the experiment. A typical two-dimensional graph, which has two axes, horizontal and a vertical axis, has room for two of these three categories of variables. Which kind of variable does not belong on the graph? The controlled variables, which is not the control. The control is a different thing in the experiment. The controlled variables are variables that you're trying to keep from varying. All right? A control is a replicate that's used for comparison. That's a different thing. But anyway, yes, that's the controlled variables shouldn't be on the graph. And that leaves the other two categories, independent and dependent. Well, to properly graph something, what should you always put on the horizontal axis? Which of the two? The independent variable. And I'm going to label it as independent variable. Don't ever do that. Don't give me a graph that says independent variable. I'm just showing you that that's what should go there. You would really put the name of that variable. Also, let's just do that for my plant experiment. What did we say the independent variable is? Concentration of nutrient solution. So that's what you would have there written out. And if that variable has units, which is not always the case, but usually is, then units should be put in parentheses. In this case, we could measure the concentration in molar. And the dependent variable should always go on the vertical axis. So growth rate, for instance, in my plant experiment, which I could do, as I said, in millimeters per week, for instance. If you want to think about this mathematically, a graph is like a function. A mathematical function takes an x value as an input from the horizontal axis, does something to that x, and then outputs a value of y. Right? So for most functions, y actually depends on x. What's an example of a function, though, for which y does not depend on x? What do we call those functions? Anyone know from math? They're called constant functions. Like y equals 3. There's no x involved, right? So a graph of that is y is 3 regardless of what x is. But most functions, there is a dependence of y on x. And in scientific experiments, really what you're trying to do by conducting the experiment is to see whether there is a dependence of your dependent variable on the independent variable. That's what you're graphically trying to do. You're philosophically, what you're doing by running an experiment is to see whether the prediction that corresponds to your hypothesis will come true. All right? Well, let's say I conduct the experiment on the plants and I get some raw data, which I then plot as points. And it might look something like this, let's say. Well, these are not perfectly collinear points, but it does look like there's a linear trend here, right? It's not just, it's probably not by accident that these are pretty close to lining up. It's not a perfect line because there's error in all measurements, right? There's variation. But if it does look like there's a linear trend, then you're justified in fitting a line to those data, a so-called line of best fit. A line of best fit, by the way, doesn't necessarily go through any of the points. A computer will do it automatically if you use a computer to do a graph. You can do it by hand, though, and it's handy to have a transparent ruler to do that so that you don't, so you can see through it and see the points. Because you want to position it so that the line of best fit gets as close as possible to as many as possible of the points. Maybe it'll go through some, maybe it won't. For mine, it looks like it's roughly here. Never hand draw a line of best fit. Use a straight edge. Okay, well, line of best fits are drawn for a couple reasons. One is that they just make looking at the data a lot easier. But more importantly, a line of best fit is a valuable measuring tool. Or I shouldn't say measuring, because no, it's not a measuring tool, it's a predictive tool. In this case, I only made 4 measurements, right? Those are my actual data, the points. Those are the only 4 concentrations that I actually prepared and tested. But now that we see that there seems to be a linear relationship, and by the way, notice that this is not a zero slope like y equals 3. This is a positive slope. So there is a dependence of y on x. It could be a negative slope either, and that would also be a dependence. Anything but a horizontal line is going to be a dependence. But anyway, once I have this fitted and I see that there seems to be a positive dependence of growth rate on nutrient solution concentration, then I might wonder what the growth rate would be for some concentration that I did not actually test. And that's where a line of best fit can give you that prediction mathematically. That brings up the final bullet point here on this slide. Interpolation and extrapolation are 2 ways of using a line of best fit to make predictions. Predictions, not measurements, because you're not actually going through with the experiment in that case. You're just guessing what the value would be if you made a, in this case, concentration of solution other than the ones that you truly did make. Interpolation and extrapolation are really exactly the same technique, but there's an important reason why we give them separate names, because they are not equal in their trustability. Interpolation is something that we routinely do in science. Extrapolation we avoid. But let me first give you the difference between the two. Inter means what? It means between. Like international, between nations. Interpolation is using a line of best fit to predict a value of the dependent variable for some value of the independent variable anywhere between the limits that you actually tested. This was the lowest one I tested. This was the highest one I tested, right? I could use the line of best fit to predict growth rate for any value of concentration between these 2 limits, and that would be interpolation because it's between those limits. How I actually do that graphically is, let's say I wanted to know what growth rate would be for whatever concentration this is. Notice I didn't actually measure it there. I measured it here and here, but not here. So I would just go up from that x value until I hit the line of best fit, and then straight over to the y-axis and read that value. Whatever that is, that's the growth rate you would expect for this concentration. That's why it's a prediction. But it's a prediction based on fitted data. All right? That's the technique. That's interpolation. But I could do exactly that same technique outside of the range that I tested. In other words, I could do it down here where it's outside of the range because it's lower than the lowest one I tested. Or I could do it up here where it's higher than the highest one I tested. Same technique, but if it's outside of the overall range, then we call it extrapolation. Extra means outside of. Now, why is there a preference over interpolation? I mean, for interpolation over extrapolation? Because things are much likely to be drastically different inside the range measured than outside. Well, first of all, about the inner range. This is why in real experiments you want to do a lot of replicates if you have time and money to do them. If you got just two values, of course you could have a perfect line of best fit between any two points, right? So you might be fooled into thinking that should have gone through that point, that is the relationship. If you only do two points, though, it might actually be that the real behavior is like this. Right? That goes through those two points, too. But it's a totally different prediction that you would make for those two different fits. On the other hand, if you made a lot of measurements and they all seem to fall in a line, then that gives you a lot more reason to believe that the true response is linear. Okay? But if you go back to this plant graph, yes, it does look like there's a linear relationship, which means the higher the concentration of solution, the greater the growth rate. But you're not justified in assuming that that's going to continue forever. If you were to get stronger and stronger solutions, it might actually end up killing the plant. Right? And if you used extrapolation to predict what it would be out here, you'd say it's this when it's actually down here. That's way off. So don't use extrapolation, use interpolation. They're the same process as far as technique is concerned, but know the difference. Okay? Any questions on those points? Then I just want to say a couple things about the actual activity. It's pretty hard to mess this up today, but you could mess it up. And you want to get good results just because it's the right thing to do, but you especially do on when you have to write things up for a report, because it's just a pain in the ass to try to write up something that went wrong. You have to try to explain it away. So be careful on doing this. All you're really doing is taking temperatures, right? Pretty straightforward, but there's a correct way to do that. You make sure that the temperature, the tip of the probe, is fully submerged. But just as importantly, make sure it's not touching glass, either the bottom or the sides. You'll get a false temperature. All right? And also, don't expect it to, within a millisecond, give you the right result. Give it a couple seconds to stabilize before you write down that temperature. And don't forget to write down that stuff. And relatedly, you're not doing the report here. You're not processing your data. All you need to do once I shut up is get your raw data, clean up, and you're done in here. Then you can deal with it later as far as writing the report. By the way, as soon as I shut up, you need to put on goggles today. It doesn't matter which style of goggles you use, but you need to have goggles on your eyes, not on your head or forehead. The whole time you're here. Don't forget to take them off before you leave. And related to safety, when you're doing these boilings, to prevent superheating, which can then all of a sudden boil over, we're using glass beads as little boiling chips. So just take three of these for each of your containers. Put them in before you put your liquid in, before you heat it up, and it won't boil out of control. But this brings up another way that you can mess things up today. Boiling. What is boiling? Well, you have to define that as a group before you start your experiment. And it's not appropriate to say boiling is the very first tiny bubble that I see form. That's a little too early. But you also don't want to wait until it's a raging boil. So you want to come to a consensus as a group before you start as to what you're going to call boiling so that you can get the temperature at that same condition for all of your four replicates. Okay? Now, a raging boil wouldn't matter for one of your replicates, which is the pure water one. I'm going to draw another graph here that has nothing to do with the graph you're making. But if you were to track the temperature continuously over time of pure water that you're heating, of course it's going to start getting warmer and warmer, right? The temperature is going to go up. But only until it hits boiling point, which, by the way, you should not expect to be 100 centigrade. That's at sea level. Measure the boiling point. Don't assume it's going to be 100 for your pure water. It won't be. Anyway, it'll heat up only, and the temperature will rise only until it hits boiling point. When it starts to boil, the temperature is going to stay the same. That additional heat that you're putting in just converts more and more of the liquid population of water molecules into gas. If you were collecting that gas, the temperature would stay the same of the liquid until there is no liquid left. And if you then continue to heat what is now all gas, then it would start heating again, or the temperature would rise again. And that's why I say it wouldn't matter. As long as you measure the temperature anywhere in this range, you're fine, because it won't change. But that's not true for the others that are true solutions. You know, if you have been boiling salt water in cooking or whatever, and it just totally forgot that you were doing it. You come back a couple hours later, and there's a totally dry pan there. All the water is gone, but there's dry salt on the bottom. So when you boil a saltwater solution, you're not evaporating the water and the salt. Salt has a much higher boiling point. You have to get it a hell of a lot hotter to actually turn that salt into liquid and then gas. So it's the water that evaporates only from the solution. And therefore, if you let it boil for a while, you're changing the concentration of your solution, right? Because you're getting rid of water and keeping the same amount of salt in there. Therefore, it's getting stronger. You're making it into a higher concentration, and you don't want to do that. You want it to be the concentration that we've measured for you, but that you would normally measure for yourself. You see what I mean there? So use the same consistent definition of boiling, but don't make it. Don't wait too long before you get the temperature. Any questions on all that? As usual, you're not handing anything in. The stuff that you fill out in your manual is for you to keep to study for the next quiz and eventually for the practicum. So don't, even though it's asking you to fill things out, that's important, but you're not giving that to me. The only thing that you get points for each class period is the quiz that you've already done. Okay, go ahead and do it. Put on your goggles first.